This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Mandates versus cookies.
Private spy agencies.
Late 70s, early 80s fantasy films.
And Mozart murder theories.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near-catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And when we get to the gaming hut, we find our pile of rule books, we find our battle mat, but also Mom made cookies. Or maybe it was beloved Patreon backer Sikander that made cookies, because Sikander has a question for us, to wit, the difference between mechanics that say to the player, you must do this, and mechanics that say, if you do this, you get a cookie. If you don't, you go into cookie debt and miss out on your next cookie. For concrete examples, Pendragon's Passions versus Gumshoe's Drives. I should say for the record that I think, this is Sikander speaking, the former should appear only when the character resents them as much as the player does, as is usually the case with Vampire's Frenzy mechanic. Robin, are you going to let this implicit diss of Pendragon's Passions mechanic stand? Or are you just going to enjoy your cookies and wait for me to pick up the banner of Greg Stafford?
Well, I guess perhaps in my gentle Canadian way, I'll, rather than, you know, slapping out at anyone, especially a beloved Patreon
member. Especially one who brought cookies.
Yeah, I'll just analyze things a little. So I would probably rephrase the distinction between these two things. But first of all, the general category is that thing that players most bitterly resent, which is constraints on their behavior.
Yes.
And why do we have constraints on their behavior in these examples? All of these are about making sure that the characters act as if they are part of the world and part of the genre. So passions, the idea that you're Arthurian knights, but you're typical skeevy murder hobos, doesn't make sense. So Greg instituted this system where you have to swear allegiance to higher virtues, and you can't just say you're like that. You have to prove it. And that means that you have to make a role, basically, in order, a very difficult role, in order to act out of the character that you have declared as part of the opening contract with the game and with the GM at the beginning. And if you fail that role, you just can't do anything. So drives, on the other hand, also require you to make a contractual agreement with the game and the GM and the genre. And that agreement in this instance isn't even so much about constraining behavior to knightly virtues, but just you have to act like a horror character by moving toward the horror. And here's why you do that.
You have to go down into the basement in your nightgown.
Right. Strictly speaking, drives are less cookie oriented than are depicted in the question, though, because the drives are basically, the way that works is the GM reminds you of your drive. Often then the phrasing is, but you do go down into the corridor because of your drive. Explain why that would be. And there is a mechanical penalty if you still choose not to do that. You lose resources. So it's not even about getting cookies, which are delicious. It's about facing attacks, right?
Well, in some cases, if you enthusiastically embody your drive, you will get a cookie in the way that many games provide you a hero point or whatever for playing up to your disadvantage. This is a thing that, you know, began, well, I think it began showing up maybe with Savage Worlds or with Steve Kenson's superhero designs. And of course, all the way back in, I guess it was Marvel Superheroes, you'd get experience points, which are like cookies, for behaving the way that a superhero ought to and not killing people. So I think that, you know, our drives are in a beautiful and storied pantheon of their own, despite not having the force of King Arthur's mailed fist behind them like passions do.
Right. Or, for example, I guess one of the early ones is in GURPS, where you get more build points for taking code versus killing.
Yeah, that's not an in-game cookie. That's a pre-cookie, really.
Yes. It's a cookie you continue to munch on every time you use whatever, you know, blast power that you purchased.
You actually bought, yes.
Right. So all of these boil down to the question of players are in the abstract willing to behave in genre, but over the course of a game will sometimes relax into just the regular way they regularly choose to play. They may look for loopholes. So, for example, they may argue that, well, I have the honor passion, so I'm just going to turn my back while the rest of you commit this skeevy murder. And so that comes down into a sort of a question of, you know, interpretation between you and the GM about what is and isn't honorable. At least it brings that subject to the table. And whether we're talking about signing a contract at the beginning or getting dinged with a tax or conversely getting a reward for in-genre actions or just having a role that you got to... a difficult role that you're probably going to fail, as in a frenzy. These are all come down to basically making the players do something that in every instance they didn't want to do, right?
Right.
Because if the character wants to follow his passion and behave honorably, there's no mechanical significance to that at all, or just follows the drive automatically.
It's just the barriers and the gutters in the bowling alley. They don't help the ball move. They just keep you out of where you shouldn't be.
Right. And in all cases, ideally, the solution is never to resort to mechanics at all, but rather to just have the person agree, right, I should be acting like this. Vampires is a little different insofar as you are sort of gaining an in-story advantage, courting a risk, and then eventually that risk comes down upon you. So it's less like these other examples, because it's not about, well, are you going to behave as a vampire, Will, in this situation? But rather, you know, after X amount of vampirage, eventually you're going to pay the price.
The better example, I think, that goes to the Sikander cookie question is not frenzy, which is basically structurally the same as a failed sanity roll. You know, in Cthulhu games, you see a horrible mythos monster, you roll your sanity. If you fail, you have to flee or scream or be insane in some fashion. Vampires, same deal, but they don't care about Cthulhu creatures. They do that for fire or blood or similar things that excite their vampiric passions or their terror. So it's more like a sanity check, which is to say more like a saving throw in many ways, than it is like a passion or a drive. The thing that I think maybe Sikander is working with an older edition, shame on you, Sikander, is the thing that constrains behavior now is the messy critical and the messy failure, which when you roll them, you are expected to act in a bestial rather than a human fashion as a vampire. And a messy critical is great fun because sure, you opened the door with your strength, but since you're a vampire, you just ripped it off its hinges and threw it down the corridor. And now, you know, A, you can't shut it, and B, that security footage is going to be very interesting to the cops. So the involuntary involvement into a character, I think, is more the messy dice and maybe a little bit the hunger dice, because again, you do things, as you say, as you lean into vampirage, eventually you're building up the better and better chance that you will, in fact, be hungry and then have to do a hunger frenzy, which is, I guess, where frenzy sort of comes around on the other end.
Another example of a flat-out bribe to do something that is in genre is in Feng Shui, where, well, I guess it's not so flat-out because it's addressed to the people who will notice bribes, which are people who are actually sensitive to them and look for the best characters mechanically to play. And for that, although it offers a number of different archetypes, it seems to me that it feels more like a Hong Kong action movie if there is a killer in it or if there is a straight up martial artist.
Right.
And so the three or four most iconic archetypes are mechanically better than the others. They're just a little bit better, but noticeably so. Mm-hmm. And by agreeing to play that character type, you're making the game feel more like a Hong Kong action movie than if you'd picked one of the adorable weirdo archetypes. And so you are accepting payment from the system. So that's definitely a cookie, and it's a cookie that enables you to mow down mooks more efficiently.
And a solution for the party full of Scoobies problem, which does happen on occasion.
Right. The caveat there, of course, is that that is a thing that works, and all of any bribe or cookie works on people who are looking for bribes. Mm-hmm. And when it's a group of 13 to 14-year-olds playing an F20 game 8 hours straight, going up all the levels, looking for bribes or point grubbing in general, if they get their hands on a build system, that's all part of the incentive for them. But the number of people who are incentivized to respond to that in your typical group, especially a typical group of adult players, is kind of low. Like, your ability to get people to do what you want through different mechanical means diminishes as people get less interested in the game mechanics, which comes with the number of systems that they play and as they find their other different sort of specialties. And you know, there's maybe one mini-maxer in your older group of players, or maybe zero. And so your ability to get them to do what you want is much more now about reminding them of the game you're playing and the contract, and that this won't be fun if you don't all act like vampires or superheroes or knights. And you will disappoint yourselves in the long run by making these short-term choices that are not, in fact, congruent with the whole thing that you agreed to play in the first place.
Yeah, in the ideal state, and I would argue that it's, unlike many ideal states, it actually happens a good bit. You move from the sort of point grubbing, I'm reluctantly taking this dissad drive, code versus killing passion, because I think that it will make me more effective in the game, into I'm doing role playing, I'm playing a knight, I'm playing an adventurer, I am not going to turtle up, I'm not going to do the thing that the bribe is meant to prevent. So I'm not saying this happens at all times, but ideally you move seamlessly from incentivized by cookie points to incentivized by playing the game as presented. And as an example, I'll just say that my Fall of Delta Green players, I don't know that I've ever invoked drives for them. They all have them. They know what they are. They roleplay them. But at no point am I like, I think you're a little reluctant to go get yourself into horrible, horrible trouble. They're in it to win it. And even if they, in character, don't want to go into the tunnel, they go into the tunnel because that's how the game works. And that's the game they signed up to play. So hopefully that is the case of more people at the table than it's not. And for the people that it's not, well, that's why we have a passion mechanic, I guess.
Right. And the whole mechanical penalty, I think it in general never comes up, but it's just there as a break glass, you know, in case someone really kicks in their heels. And I guess that gets to a different segment and a different design issue, is how much do you put in rules to deal with the challenging player, and do those rules annoy everybody else? Or are they fine as long as nobody has to, you know, break the glass? And That's a design question I've been confronted with on multiple occasions. And again, it's a different segment.
Right. And I believe that once we are teasing a different segment and coincidentally out of cookies, it's time to pack up our bags and boxes and books, leave the gaming hut, and move through this commercial into another hut where I'll bet we're going to be having those bags, boxes, and books searched for microdots.
''1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula Dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase.
It's time once more to undergo the retinal scan, the increasingly easy security clearance depending on where you live, and enter the Tradecraft Hut, where this time around, as we look at the world of espionage, beloved patron backer David Soa asks, I've watched the first half of Black Doves. And by this time, I'm sure the rest of Black Doves has been watched or abandoned. And it has me wondering about the general topic.
It's a coin flip.
Yeah. Private, for-profit spy organizations. Any real-world examples? Seems unlikely. Does CARDIS have any info or opinions? And Ken, it turns out that this likely thing is not only likely, it's so likely that it was the original thing in the first place.
Right. Yeah, private intelligence organizations. Certainly in the modern era, you can go back and forth as to what extent Rome had a civilian intelligence arm or Maurya India had one. But certainly by the time we get countries that keep bureaucratic records, we still have private intelligence orgs seem to be older than governmental ones. In Europe, for example, Thurn and Taxis from episode 440 was a private postal service and intelligence org before any European state except Venice had an intelligence service. The great spy masters of the early modern era, we're talking Walsingham, Richelieu, you know, it's not like Wild Bill Donovan showing up and saying, we should have a spy service, let me run it. They said, I have a spy service already. Do you mind if I use it for the good of the crown and maybe a couple of nickels here and there? And sure enough, Elizabeth and Louis were both smart enough to say, that sounds like a great plan, because if a guy shows up with a spy service, by and large, you want him inside the Chamber Noir, not outside. So the British East India Company and Lloyd's of London both had their own intelligence services. Lloyd's used to basically have a guy that would go to the Admiralty and they'd have their list of all the ship movements they knew about in the world, and they'd trade lists with the guy at the Admiralty, was how that worked.
And it's very funny to think of Lloyd's as having an intelligence service, but that's insurance investigators. Yeah. That's still a thing, and they undoubtedly still have investigators.
Absolutely. Actually, I think, isn't Lloyd's gone? Maybe I'm wrong. And of course, in America, we had the Pinkertons in the Civil War doing our civilian intelligence service. The only intelligence in the Civil War was military intelligence at that point. And the Confederacy, I don't even think, had a civilian intelligence service. They counted on state, you know, judges and whatnot to run things, which is part of why they lost. And that tradition, the Pinkertons still exist. Lloyd's still exists. Thurn and Taxis is sadly no longer with us. but there are absolutely private intelligence gathering firms today. And these run from sort of newsletters that you sign up for if you're a big wheel, and they purport to examine the real state of intelligence and geopolitics. So you may be familiar with Janes, who produce Janes fighting ships and Janes combat aircraft, Strat4, which is basically a private OSINT service. Beloved coup advisor Edward Luttwak has a newsletter that he does. Bellingcat flips the newsletter script and pretends to be a journalistic service, but it's still the same deal. Those are the episode 582. We saw Bellingcat. And then there's high dollar consultants that do specific deep dive spy on demand investigations. And this is somewhere in the shadowy world between a business consultant and a private detective. But Smith Brandon in the UK, for example, just does that. And if you want information about French government decision-making policy because you've got a business deal going down in France, get Smith Brandon. They'll bring you a dossier.
Right. Now, these are literally intelligence operations in that they are providing information to clients.
Right.
And as far as we know, are not doing the sort of intelligence work that gets streaming TV shows made about you, which is like with guns and bombs and all of that
right.
stuff. Except
one doubts that Strat4 has Keira Knightley shooting people. Although if they did, they'd be cooler. I'm just going to put that right out there.
Right. But you could easily just create that premise where right. it's all of that. Plus you have glamorous spies, you know, right. stealing documents and stuff and getting into trouble and going rogue, of course.
Right. Well, they absolutely have spies stealing documents. That is straight up known because they've all been prosecuted for it. The OSINT market is $10 billion alone. And that is just the private market because, of course, governments also pay for these things. The companies and the way that the governments get the contracts back and forth is that these companies usually hire former intelligence operatives or officials, sometimes very, very high level ones if they're a bigger, fancier company, and they have them on their board or their staff. And that, of course, then leads to the who's wagging which dog question. Are these allegedly private services just deniable government operations? Is the government laundering things back and forth? Or conversely, are these agencies using the government for their own nefarious ends, at the very least, to open up markets in other countries? And the example of that is Booz Allen, which began long and long ago as a engineering firm and contracting firm, and then has drifted over the century that it's been in existence to basically doing cybersecurity and data analysis type work. But they were famously the contractor that was doing cybersecurity for the National Security Agency, the NSA, and they hired a guy named Edward Snowden to do it with results that we saw splattered across the front pages for years and years. And Booz Allen, by the way, makes $10.7 billion a year all by itself. They were hired by the United Arab Emirates to build their NSA from the ground up. They do a lot of other similar jobs in the Middle East. And do they get those contracts because they have former CIA deputy directors on their board? Who can say? Bloomberg in 2013 called Booz Allen the world's most profitable spy agency, although I will point out that Bloomberg did not have the GRU balance sheet to look at.
Right. And the GRU is not a strictly private organization.
No, the GRU is a public-private partnership, as we talked about when we talked about Wagner Group in episode 504, which I guess leads us to the sort of allied concept. And you say, well, surely Janes fighting ships doesn't have Keira Knightley shooting people. That would be uncool, though maybe they have people taking pictures in shipyards that shouldn't be, or even going into ship companies and saying, I'll get a nice job if I send this to my buddy at Janes.
Right. And if nothing else, sliding envelopes across the table right. to other people who shouldn't have been looking at those ships.
Right. But once you get to something like Booz Allen, I think that the odds flip the other way. And it's like Booz Allen may have people in Booz Allen corporate security who regretfully occasionally have to shoot a guy, and maybe it's allowed because they're in a foreign land where shooting rules are more lax, but maybe it's not. Who can say? But once you're getting into the billions of dollars high-level NSA contract work, even if they're not shooting someone, they probably have a guy on speed dial who can go shoot someone
for them. If you're Sultan, that you're building this multi billion-dollar infrastructure for calls you up and says, well, I know this isn't in the brochure, but maybe you're going to find Keira Knightley with her gun.
Who can say? And so as I was alluding to, Wagner is a private mercenary company, private security and mercenary companies, which overseas often act as on their own intelligence operators because they don't want to be inserted into a situation they know nothing about. But also they provide intelligence gathering to whoever their patron power is. Wagner does so for the GRU. Aegis does so for MI6. Constellus, which is what OG Blackwater is now, does so for the CIA. And these companies, the private security, this is another multi-billion dollar industry. They don't have quite the fat contracts they were getting during the war on terror when they were making as much as $50 billion a year, these companies, but it's still not nothing. And altogether, they're at least a Booz Allen. Then there's risk analysis consultants. And this goes back to the 60s where you had CIA guys and MI6 guys sort of spinning off think tanks that did risk analysis for companies as a way of getting information about the companies, but also they did their work. So Control Risks Group in Britain is an example of them. Then there are pure business intelligence companies, which are basically fancier PIs, like I was talking about Smith Brandon. Black Cube, which is basically Mossad, but with better suits, is very, very famous for doing a lot of things, including maybe favors they shouldn't have done for Harvey Weinstein. But they basically provide corporate espionage, call it what it is. And then the next rung down or away or over is companies that specialize in information warfare. They do psychological operations online. They generally clothe that as being political consultants. And that's your Cambridge Analytica, now Emmer Data. That's Fusion GPS. And that's companies like that. And those are generally any rich democracy has political consultants that also, if asked, will do the odd job of hacking or building a phony dossier from alleged spy contacts. And that is part of business in the modern world now, because we're all online, whether we want to be or not.
Right. Any of these people literally or plausibly can have bodyguards with them, a phalanx of bodyguards. And you know what happens when something goes wrong and you have a bunch of burly bodyguards with military experience. You might send them out to go do the covert operative stuff. And the other thing that we've been kind of dancing around is this tripod has three legs. It's not just question of private and governmental, but also many governments are essentially criminal operations.
Right, yeah.
And so the distinction between, you know, working for Wagner and, you know, they're just also committing flat out crimes. And there are the number of administrations that are blatantly criminal seems to be on the rise these days. And so you've got a whole mix in there where if you, as a player character, go to work for one of these apparently above board private operations, you might find out that the document that you're gathering is for a drug lord, or, hey, what is this guy who's, you know, part of a terrorist group who's supposed to be opposed to this government? Why am I working for them? So the opportunities for things to get murky as a player character being run by a shadowy organization like this get big fast, even before it turns out that one of them is a vampire.
Yeah. And I guess I did leave out, you know, the thing that is so much their own stereotype, we forget that they're technically intelligence operators, you know, the hacker for hire. Lots and lots and lots of those. Some of them are remote. They're in Moldova or wherever, and you contact them on the internet and you give them a target and they give you the information. Some of them are in-house. For example, the United States Department of Justice was just hacked and all of the confidential case files, probably by one or another of the Mexican cartels. And once again, that's classic intelligence work. You find a secret government database, you hack into it, you download all the information. You know, the Chinese, when they did it to Office of Personnel Management a few years back under the Obama administration, well, that's a government. That's clearly spying. Well, if the Sinaloa cartel is doing it, it's still spying. We just have sort of a different place that we put it in our hearts. And if you're asking, does the Sinaloa cartel send people around to shoot people? Yes, they absolutely do.
That is well documented. Right. Also, a thing that we traditionally think of as being the output of governmental intelligence agencies is disinformation. Well, disinformation for hire is also another gigantic industry. And sometimes that is directed to just being part of a greater nexus of a scam that is meant to drain individual people's bank accounts. So that's further on the crime side of the continuum. But even more so, there are now all sorts of shops all around the world of people hunched over their computers looking bleary who are, you know, going to jump onto any news story and flood social media with disinformation meant to bend people toward a particular political point of view or just to the idea that truth is unimaginable and you get to pick your own truth, which is, I think, an objective of a lot of governments around the world. And there's definitely a lot of people doing that for different clients, depending on who's willing to pay them.
And again, that goes back to the weaponization of advertising, which began under the Wilson administration in America, where ad agencies were basically hired by the government to spread propaganda and call it disinformation now. They called it propaganda then, but same basic job description. And that has happened over and over and over. So you could imagine one of these big transnational ad agencies that somewhere in their security office, maybe they have Keira Knightley and maybe she goes around and, you know, is supposed to be providing the basis for a good disinfo attack. But every now and again, she's got to kill a guy because she's Keira Knightley and she's too busy to be slowed down with a bunch of tedious questions.
So any of these could be backgrounds for an esoterror player character who works for the Erudo Veritatis. They're known for drawing people from all over the shadow world and not necessarily always being super picky about it. So this could also be a background for your character in Esoterris as well as Knights Black Agents.
And all of these groups are potential nodes for Knights Black Agents to be run by vampires or at least be the very happy to take vampire gold for vampires, even if they're not straight up Renfielded.
Right. And the disinformation shop, that is also something they could be hired by an esoteric cell or they could be esoteric. So lots of opportunities to not only watch Black Doves, but to create your own scenarios that draw on those tropes. And when we've got to that part of our segment, it's time for us to sneak out of this segment before Keira Knightley gets us. We wouldn't want that.
Well, would we?
Well, not with a gun.
I mean, you know, take what you can get, frankly.
Well, you've been shot already. I defer to you on how unpleasant it is.
Right. Well, this outro is taking longer than the intro, so it's definitely time to dust off our fingerprints and bolo out of here.
In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Keep this podcast and the cookies it needs to continue by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Svebor Mijic,
Donovan Herter,
Matthew Preston,
Michael Bowman,
and Michael Harrison.
The whir of the projector, the smell of the popcorn, and the feel of that sticky stuff under our feet that they just can't clean up welcome us once more to the center seats in the center aisle of the Cinema Hut, where we settle back in for our Fantasy Film Essentials series. And as we've gotten to the midpoint of the 70s last time, we are going to finish out the 70s and head into, you know, the premier decade for fantasy and everything else. So we're going to start, though, in 1975 with a fantasy film that I believe, pound for pound, more people in our hobby and art form have memorized than any other fantasy film.
Yeah, and of course, even if you haven't seen this film, you've experienced the entire film just through people quoting it over your years of playing role-playing sessions. So it's Monty Python and the Holy Grail from 1975, directed a famously sort of tense duo of Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones from the Monty Python troupe. It's a sketch comedy formed into a narrative that falls apart, and it is Arthurian myth. It's a spoof of Arthurian myth, but if it's got King Arthur and knights who say knee and a killer rabbit, it is definitely a fantasy film, as well as being part of its, you know, core genre, which is comedy. So it is already is part of our lore. There's already a Monty Python and the Holy Grail role-playing game. And you may be tired of hearing those references at the table. You may be delighted to keep making those references, but especially for its generation was a combination of nerdiness and sort of a knowing deconstruction that I think has left its imprint on at least one generation of nerd culture minds. And if an alien from another planet wants to see a bunch of fantasy films and hasn't seen that, tell the alien to watch Monty Python and the Holy Grail when he gets to the mid-70s.
And if you've seen it 100 times, the jokes maybe have lost their effect, but it genuinely is a great comedy. The Pythons, of course, by then were masters of the sketch. The genius of running a whole bunch of sketches together, which is basically what Morton Arthur is in the first place. It's just a tremendously good movie. And I urge you, if you have not given it a chance, possibly because of being quoted endlessly to you, give it a shot. It still holds up in a lot of ways as a comedy. And it is, at the very least, an essential pillar of our nonsensical thing that we do.
Next, you're going to sing the praises of a film that takes the underground comic scene of the late 60s and in 1977 puts it in animated form on the big screen. And that's Wizards from 1977 by Ralph Bakshi.
Yeah, this is Bakshi's sort of first major film. He made sort of underground films, Fritz the Cat, Heavy Traffic, his classics. But this is his big one, and it is a Bakshization of Lord of the Rings, which eventually he would actually Bakshize Lord of the Rings. But this is his first and open take on it. It's set in a post-apocalyptic world. The bombs have dropped. People have mutated into trolls and fairies and elves and dwarves and orcs. And the orcs are human mutants, and they are gathered up by an evil wizard named Black Wolf. And Black Wolf discovers a film projector and uses it to magically project Nazi propaganda films from World War II, turning his orcs, his mutants, into a unstoppable army. And so, sure enough, there have to be elves that deal with the situation. They convert one of Black Wolf's robots to a new peace robot. And the whole thing is just mind-bogglingly colorful and imaginative and different and vibey, but it's also the same exact story that you know, plus lots of earthy humor because it's Bakshi. And it is also, in addition to all those other great triumphs, the rotoscoped animation is beautiful and very technically impressive for 77. It's also the film debut of Mark Hamill. So he plays a mountain fairy and guard captain. So there we are. And all of that together, I think, it had a giant effect at the very least on Bakshi's own Lord of the Rings. And then I believe this film specifically stands alone as a way to take sort of modern day political concerns and do them in a fantastic universe without ruining everyone's fantasy vibe. But still, at no point is this film subtle. It's just very straightforward. But, you know, that's the great thing about fantasy. Good and evil aren't subtle.
Speaking of good and evil, both are featured in Time Bandits. Terry Gilliam is back on our list in 1980 with the story of a young boy with distracted, neglectful parents who is whisked off on a time travel journey by a group of diminutive bandits played by David Rappaport, Kenny Baker as part of the crew of Chrono Bandits. I'm sure you've encountered them in your travels, Ken.
Oh, yes.
And they meet a number of mythic and historical figures played by a huge roster of 70s stars, particularly comedy stars. So John Cleese is Robin Hood. You've got Catherine Helmond as the wife of an ogre. Ian Holm shows up as Napoleon. Michael Palin is in there. The most memorable of these sort of cameo roles is Sean Connery as Agamemnon, turning on his full Sean Connery powers. David Warner plays the incarnation of evil. Ralph Richardson is a gloriously befuddled version of the Supreme Being, one of several versions of the Supreme Being that occurs in the film. And the spirit of Roald Dahl is at work in this. And again, it has a mean streak and a willingness to dispose of parents that is sort of bracing. It is full of Gilliam's rebellious spirit and is, I think, one of his more coherent films because the time travel allows him to move from episode to episode in a way that makes sense and builds and is one of the great looks of fantasy film that Gilliam, although he's not necessarily the production designer, obviously is giving sketches to the production designer. And I think this is one of the great versions of his classic visual style.
Yeah, everything you say about it is true. It is a stone delight. I saw it in the theater and have seen it on big screens and small ever since. It never gets old, even more than Python, I think. It stays successful and fresh just because there's so much rich visual invention that you do forget certain segments until you see them again for the 9th or 12th or 15th time. And you're like, oh, right. This isn't just Agamemnon, because as you say, Connery really does take over this movie and make it his own, despite being in it, you know, for maybe 9 minutes or whatever. It's a thrill ride of the best kind. And it is something that I think is the best fantasy does this. It is both uplifting and mean spirited. And I love that combo. And Roald Dahl is very much to be called out as the mean spirited half of this. And the uplift, I think, comes from, you know, Gilliam. I think that's who brings it in this case. So it's a terrific movie. And dare I say, Robin, a timeless classic.
Right. Speaking of timeless classics, the best, most mythic, most gleaming, most visually rich, most star-studded version of the Arthurian legend comes from 1981. It's directed by John Boorman, and that, of course, is Excalibur. This is one of those films where every visual image is essentially burned on the brain. It doesn't shy away from the love triangle that a lot of directors who want to do King Arthur for an Anglo-Saxon audience want to desperately run away from. And the cast is incredibly stacked, not just Nigel Terry or Nicol Williamson as Merlin, Helen Mirren as Morgan Le Fay. She's so good in that. Sherry Lungi as Guinevere. And then even in the small roles, whoever was the casting director on this film, I mean, obviously they went to see a bunch of RSC productions.
Yeah.
But this has Patrick Stewart, Liam Neeson, Gabriel Byrne, and Ciaran Hinds all in secondary or tertiary roles. And they bring so much authenticity to the film with their Shakespearean presence. And the film looks so great. It's so burnished looking. The armor looks fabulous. Nicol Williamson is like the weirdest, best, non-long flowy beard Merlin. You can't assemble a Arthurian filmography without making this the top of that heap.
Yeah. Interestingly, this is what John Boorman did when he was not able to do a film version of Lord of the Rings, that he had that fantasy thing that he wanted to get out. And you talk about the casting, he makes sure to cast Nicol Williamson and Helen Mirren on the other side of a very bad love affair. And they hated each other. And he said, great, work with that. That's the energy we want. And he really had to talk them into playing those parts. But that is a part of why that film works so well. you talk about the shining armor, which of course we remember endlessly, the use of Carmina Burana before it was a cliche. This is why it's a cliche, is the musical stings and the knightly charges, the rest of it. It feels Arthurian, and it also feels like the best product of the 80s glossy film tradition. And so it is a period piece that is ironically even better because it's such a period piece. And everything, all the 80s decisions, the late 70s RSC, as you say, decisions that went into this are part of what makes it an absolute eternal classic. And the fact that, as you imply, no one has been able to touch it yet with any of the zillion other King Arthur movies that have come after it. So even if it weren't John Borman, it would be the best Arthur on screen. And as John Borman, it becomes the sort of ordeal film that all of his best movies are, and does so with the greatest ordeal narrative in secular literature. So there we go. Good job on Excalibur. I've watched it like twice in the last 2 years for various reasons, and it still is gobsmackingly amazing, the things that he was able to capture on film and through music and sound and light, and also, as you say, a absolute murderer's row of acting.
And now, speaking of films that begin with ordeals, you're here to perhaps not sing, but perhaps grunt the praises of 1982's Conan the Barbarian, directed by John Milius, and of course with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the leading role.
First of all, there's no need to grunt anything in a movie with this Basil Poledouris score. Conan the Barbarian is, we talk about things that are the expression of a directorial vision. Conan the Barbarian may be the best argument for the auteur theory ever filmed, in that this is as John Milius a thing as has ever existed. And to the extent it departs from the Robert E. Howard character, it departs in a Milius direction. But I would argue that John Milius himself is not a million miles from Robert E. Howard artistically. And so even when it doesn't work, it works. Schwarzenegger's Conan is a physical entity, less the sort of clever fox that Conan is in the stories. But he is fortunately given a number of clever sidekicks, Subutai, played by Jerry Lopez, and Valeria, played by Sandahl Bergman, and one of the greatest of villains ever, James Earl Jones, in this case, the villainous Thulsa Doom. The story of Conan seems to take a while to get going, but all of what Milius is doing is laying the groundwork so that when the final confrontation between Conan and Thulsa Doom occurs, every part of it is believable, in emotionally believable in the story, believable in the action beats, and the whole film is done with this sort of attention to not verisimilitude, but to realism, to the sort of content that you think, well, this is the only way this can happen now. This is inevitable. And that is another thing that Robert E. Howard, I think, would approve of in this film. Dino De Laurentiis produced it and somehow kept his grubby mitts off of it. It doesn't look or feel like any of the Dino movies from the era, in that it is actually got sharp edges and is not sort of softened in any real direction. There's some comedy and some philosophy, but again, all of that comes out of Milius's brain or off of Howard's page. It is maybe the greatest fantasy film ever made, and is certainly a cornerstone of what fantasy film has become.
So there's going to be a theme developing, especially in our next segment, of me being kind of meh on a number of films that people love from this period. So I'm hoping you'll step in and love them all, as you do with Conan the Barbarian, which has no third act. And it's time now to head into an unusual corner to wrap up our podcast. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Canons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcanons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
The whispers, the darting eyes. Otherwise, in other situations, the screen's full of nonsense. But in this case, I guess the whispers and the scribblings of quill pens tell us that we're in the conspiracy corner. And these days, the conspiracies we most enjoy are very old, innocuous ones. And so that put me in mind, since we talked about Bergman's magic flute last week, into the various theories that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was murdered.
Dun, dun, dun.
And so, Ken, you're here to give us the true regular ordinary story and then the various semi-paranoid filigrees that arose from it.
Some of them straight-up paranoid filigrees, I will say that. So, 1791, the last year of Mozart's life, he has begun to turn the corner. He's started to get regular annuities. He's finally scraping himself to the upper middle class success that he's been trying to for his whole 35 years of life. And an example of this is that Count von Walsegg commissions him to write a requiem mass for his deceased wife. This is in mid-July of 1791. Walsegg had a practice of commissioning music from other writers, other composers, and then passing it off as his own. Mozart was like, 300 ducats is 300 ducats, let's do this. But he is beginning to fall ill as he works on the Requiem. He is ill when he goes to Prague in August 1791 for a different opera that he's presenting for the coronation of Emperor Leopold II. He is in Prague, not feeling good. He moves back to Vienna, his normal home. By September 30th of 1791, he conducts the magic flute, so he's healthy enough to do that. Magic flute is then performed many, many times between even then and his death. It's the hit of the season. He works mostly on the Requiem between October and November of 1791. On November 15th, 1791, he completes the Little Masonic Cantata, Kirkel 623, which makes that the not quite penultimate piece that he does. The Requiem is penultimate.
Right. And the Kirkel numbers are a catalog number created by a musicologist named Kirkel, right, which is how Mozart's various pieces are distinguished.
And it's how you tell which Mozart, because they're all things like minuet and G. And so you just have to figure out which one you're talking about. This one has a fun name because it's commissioned by the Masons to dedicate one of their Masonic temples in Vienna. And as I say, it's Kirkel 623. 626, I believe, is the Requiem. So there aren't a lot of things in between. He's confined to his bed on November 20th, 1791. His wife basically is worried that he's working on the Requiem too hard. She takes it away from him, but he keeps sneaking it back because he's, you know, working on a masterpiece and he's Mozart. But by December 6th, 1791, his sweating, body swelling, his edema, and his fever and vomiting have gotten to a level where it's just untenable. He dies shortly after midnight on December 6th, 1791, at age 35. He is taken to St. Mark's Cemetery, buried in a unmarked shaft grave. This is seems to be unusual if you're Mozart that you don't get a headstone, but back in those days, Emperor Leopold was trying to cut down on everyone wasting money on funerals. So if you weren't noble, you didn't get a headstone. You got put in a shaft grave with five or six other people. His death is reported as miliary fever, which means that his goosebumps were the size of grains of millet. The trouble is, we don't know what that means. It might have been typhus. It might have been a sweating sickness. It could have been rheumatic fever or nephritis. Both can be triggered by strep. And there do seem to have been an epidemic of streptococcus infections. Some eager historian has gone through like 5,000 death records from the same month and noticed that a lot of them are dying of this same thing. And another theory is that Mozart was a hypochondriac, used to douse himself with patent medicine. And patent medicines at the time, a lot of them had antimony in them. And so maybe it was antimony poisoning. But just the research that people did in the epidemiology makes me think it's probably strep that triggered either rheumatic fever or nephritis. Both match his symptoms. Right.
And it was a lot easier to die of strep throat in 1791 than today.
But before sulfa drugs, it was darn right simple to die of strep throat. So Constanza, his widow, now has a half-finished requiem, and she needs to big it up in the public mind. She is not on team Count Volzak gets to claim it, so she has it performed, the parts that he's already written, as soon as she possibly can. She hires other composers to forge Mozart's handwriting to finish it so that she'll get the second installment of those 300 ducats. And then she begins to say that Mozart was thinking of the requiem, obsessed with the requiem at his death, claimed that he felt he was writing the requiem for himself. So this, obviously, Mozart's dying work is a requiem mass, dun, dun, dun. And then later on, she said, Constanza, I am only too conscious. My end will not be long in coming for sure. Someone has poisoned me. I cannot rid my mind of this thought. And this is Constanza quoting Mozart in later years. The Berlin newspaper, however, did pick up on the rumors. So they are contemporary with his death. This is a week after his death. They say that the swelling of his body and the condition of it implies poison. And they mentioned that he had many enemies amongst the cabals who he had infuriated with his sans souci behavior. So that story is a Mozart family legend. His son would repeat it endlessly. And in 1803, for example, musicologists and medicos argued back and forth in a series of monographs. So this conspiracy theory goes back almost to the moment of Mozart's death.
Right. And Constanza's version of this became more elaborate over the years. So in 1829, near the end of her life, she is interviewed by the British musicologist Vincent Novello, and she spices it up even more and purportedly quotes him as saying, because maybe Novello spiced it up, I know I must die. Someone has given me aqua tofana and has calculated the precise time of my death for which they have ordered a requiem. It is for myself that I'm writing this. So in this version, someone has killed him in order to get him to write a requiem for himself. And of course, as in many stories in the final segment of this podcast, it's too good to be true because aqua tofana, which is a mixture of arsenic and lead, produces a bunch of even more horrible symptoms than the one that he had. And did not at all match the symptoms he had when he died.
But where there is a dubious poisoning, there have to be dubious poisoners. And this is where the fun starts. And everybody has heard the theory that he was murdered by his jealous rival composer, Antonio Salieri. Salieri is born 6 years before Mozart. He was Italian instead of Austrian. So he was composing within the fashionable mode of the time. And if you're getting a composer for your court, you need an Italian. They're the best composers. Everyone knows this. So he kept beating Mozart out for jobs throughout the 1780s. Contemporary reports, including in Beethoven's diary, peg him as the murderer. Salieri eventually attempts suicide, slashing his throat in 1823, confined to an asylum, and denied it to the asylum workers, and they wrote it down, and it's in the asylum records. But he also allegedly denounced himself in the asylum, but he's in an insane asylum in 1823. Asylum. So
yeah,
whatever.
So, but he's in a hallucinatory state of possibly dementia at this point. So that is not the confession that closes the case.
No, it does not. Pushkin is the guy who figures out what motive Salieri would have to murder Mozart. Salieri was successful. Mozart was a schmuck. Pushkin says, art made him murder Mozart. He was jealous of Mozart's godly art when Mozart was not at all godly. And this you may recognize from the Miloš Forman film Amadeus, 1984, based on the Peter Schaeffer play, 1979, which is based, as it turns out, on Pushkin's play Mozart and Salieri from 1830. In the mid there, Rimsky-Korsakov does an opera of it in 1898. And I've got to say, look at the stones on Rimsky-Korsakov to do an opera about Mozart. Well done, son.
Yes. Right. So when you have people of that caliber calling you a murderer, that does
stick.
Tend to stick. I remember having an argument with a film professor when I was an undergrad about, but this is clearly untrue. And the movie, you know, accuses a dead guy of murder, and the argument of the professor, yeah, but it's a great story, which I guess was a difference in my perspective.
Right. Well, whatever.
Right. And when you think about the movie, you are shown Salieri in the last years of his life. And so you can, although I don't think it's intended to be framed that way, since he narrates the film, you can conclude that that is his delusion of what happened.
Right.
And I think there's probably even a hint of that that's more in the movie than in the play. However, one thing that all of these theories fail to convey is that at the time, Salieri was much more successful than Mozart.
Yeah, hugely successful.
His stuff is not performed today the way that Mozart's is, but career-wise, arguably because of his connections and proper behavior.
And being Italian.
he was considered successful and Mozart was a struggling upstart.
Right. And people who try to fun ruin this say, well, Mozart's own diary says that Salieri accompanied him to a performance of Magic Flute and couldn't say enough good things about it. It's like, I don't know how many of the people who say this have ever had enemies, but that's exactly what you do if your enemy's got a thing out. You don't mock it to his face. You say, that's great. And then you backstab him. So anyway,
right. Well, even the people who say he murdered him say that he thought Mozart was really great because that's right, why he murdered him.
That's the whole point. But from jealous Salieri, we move to the more plausible, although not actually still true, jealous husband theory. Mozart had a woman named Magdalena Hofdamel as a piano student, and this began in 1790 after she had her kid. You know, she can turn the kid over to the nanny. She has to get out of the house again. And Mozart was known to play around with his students in a non-musical capacity. Not cool, but there we are. And her husband, Franz, assaulted Magdalena on December 10th, 1791, so like 5 days after Mozart's death, with a razor, and then committed suicide. This becomes a giant cause célèbre, and the rumor was that it was about Mozart, that that's why he attacked her. And so later, when people start talking about poison, they say maybe Franz Hofdamel poisoned him. The question being, how would he possibly have gotten poison into Mozart's food over and over? But don't worry, Robin. People who imagine things have come up with a solution. He actually bonked him on the head with his cane. In 1855, Mozart's skull, so-called, surfaced, miraculously was found for the centennial. Robin, you're so happy. And it shows a bad contusion on one of the sutures. And people say, well, there it is. He got banged on the head. Blood flooded into his brain. And he died of that.
Right. Well, you can tell it's his skull because it has a Kirkel number.
Right. Exactly. And sure, often you get hit on the head and then you vomit and develop goosebumps the size of millet seeds and your feet and hands swell up. That's a known consequence of a concussion. Anyway, the more fun version of the murder theory, or at least it begins fun, is that he's murdered by the Freemasons, because Walsegg is a Freemason. Mozart is a Freemason. But Mozart supposedly reveals Masonic secrets and or subverts Masonry in The Magic Flute, which is a very Masonic opera. And that's part of what gave it its cachet, was people were getting a little, you know, secret society vibe when they went and saw it. He reportedly had become dissatisfied with the Masons. Maybe they weren't getting enough jobs, but he was going to found a separate fraternal order, the Grotto, Die Grotta. And the theory is that the Masonic clarinetist Stadler, who was one of his buddies, poisoned him. A fellow named G.F. Domer in 1861 suggested it wasn't just the Masons. It was a secret order within the Masons. The Illuminati, one of their many names, did it. Lots of excitement.
Well, that makes this a full-on conspiracy theory. Exactly. Worthy of treatment in Conspiracy Corner.
And this is where everything gets magical and immediately gets much worse, because once you start proposing that shadowy conspirators are murdering people, it doesn't take too long before some German ruins it. Matilda Ludendorff, I'm looking at you, wife of General Ludendorff, who says that an alliance of Jesuits and Masons, headed by the Jews, killed Mozart because of his powerful German nationalist music. She also interprets The Magic Flute as about the rescue of Marie Antoinette from the French Revolution. That's who Pamina is supposed to be. And she makes much a ritual significance of the fact that Mozart is buried in a black cloth with no grave marker, and that his head was removed, because, of course, by 1928, they found this skull. And so she says he must have been beheaded before he was put in the ground. That's not true. None of this is true. But it was a big bit of the sort of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that were flying around Germany and other places in the 20s. So let's stick to the Jesuits and Masons myself, but there we are. A later German rescues this theory, I think, 1971. He says, no, all of that is a red herring. The Magic Flute is actually a Rosicrucian opera about the contest over the 18th degree of Masonry. And that's why the number 18 appears so many times in the opera. And scholars of opera say, really? But Kerner's on a roll. He says Mozart is killed as a Masonic sacrifice by mercury poisoning, masterminded by the Illuminati member Baron Gottfried von Sweeten, and that the Rosicrucian diplomat Baron Konstanz von Jacobi Kloost commissioned the Requiem at the behest of the Rosicrucian King Frederick of Prussia. The funeral is a cover-up, and Mozart was really buried in the foundation of the Masonic Temple for which he wrote that cantata. And Mozart, in this weird neo-witch cult theory, went willingly to his sacrificial death because the Masons told him that he had to go. And that's why he wrote the big opera about Rosicrucianism, to sort of demonstrate his willingness. And it's also why the word mercury keeps appearing both in that opera and in the cantata. And Kerner says that the handwriting of the cantata displays the characteristic signs of mercury poisoning, which is wild if true, given that Mozart displayed none of the characteristic signs of mercury poisoning. But there we are.
So you could say that parts of the conspiracy are true and have your characters in the 1790s trying to get the real copy of the play with the mystical secrets in it to prevent it from being performed and prevent the ritual from coming into being. And surely if Mozart wasn't the sacrifice, some other person has been selected to be the sacrifice. You want to save them. Or you can, of course, use that device to, the, you know, that the they were secret pages of the magic flute. Those are the ones that have all the 18s in them. And you got to save them and either prevent them from being performed or to have them be performed in order to undo whoever's behind the grand Masonic ritual, which has to have some other import other than just, you know, christening a building.
Dedicating a temple, which is, yeah, pretty low rate for murdering Mozart. I feel like you should get more bang for that buck. The other famously missing bits of things is the missing notes from the Requiem. We have the Requiem manuscript, and graphologists can tell which is Mozart's writing and which is the writing of Süssmayr, who's the guy who mostly finished it. But Süssmayr, for his whole life, said he wrote it up from Mozart's notes. And of course, he had to say that because Constanze wants the money. But he kept up that story long after there was any reason to say so. And you'd think that he'd be saying, no, I finished Mozart. I'm that guy. But he was very, very clear that he worked from notes. And then people would say, can we see those notes? And he would say, oh, no, I lost them. So
yes, his notes were him humming to me.
Exactly.
What the things were supposed to be.
Right. And so the lost notes of the Requiem, I think, would be powerful death magic if you're looking to involve vampires or black magicians or, again, the witch cult in this nonsense, because I think that's a danger, frankly, that all this could be going on. And you can easily say that the Queen of the Night in Magic Flute is not necessarily Maria Theresa or a Freemasonic model of architecture, but is actually the witch goddess Herodias or Diana or Aradia or whatever name you're giving her. And that this is actually all Margaret Murray witch murders. And that's why there's so many weirdly slashed throats in this story about a guy who was poisoned, possibly by a clarinetist.
Well, now that we've presented a number of plot hooks, it's time for us to melodically, with great rhythmic brio, bring this particular episode of Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff to an end. But guess what? There'll be another one a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pellegrin Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from murderous rabbits by joining such backers as
Michael Manivel.
Monster Talk.
Christian Grunseth.
Brian Malcolm.
And Taylor Harless.
Wear this show, we're drinking from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, Subtlety is for People Who Forgot Their Battering Ram.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.